Court. My name is Mark Porto. I'm an attorney in Grand Island, and I'm here today on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Eugene Cozy. The fundamental problem in this case is that the primary evidence of Mr. Cozy's guilt at trial was the identification of him by a confidential informant that was the product of an unduly suggestive identification procedure, and the admissibility of that identification at trial violated Mr. Cozy's right to due process.
What was unduly suggestive about the identification process?
Yes, Your Honor. So what happened essentially was that there was a meeting between a confidential informant and a person who went by the moniker G in rural Clay County on October 17th, in the morning of October 17th, 2016. Later that day, they arranged to do a mere methamphetamine transaction later that evening, and then that subsequently did occur. Although the problem was the confidential informant did not know the name, the specific name of the person who went by the name G. So subsequently, the Officer Hayes, who was managing the confidential informant, asked around to neighboring police agencies if they knew somebody, an African-American male, who went by the moniker G, and was told that Mr. Cozy was known to use that moniker. The Hastings Police Department sent Officer Hayes a picture of Mr. Cozy, and then what happened was, to answer your question, Officer Hayes sent a text message to the confidential informant, which contained a picture of Mr. Cozy, and said essentially, is this the guy?
Do we have the text message?
No.
Or the photo in our record?
No. The evidence at trial, or that the motion to suppress, was that that text message had subsequently been destroyed. The
well,
trial,
if it indeed said, is this the guy, what is suggestive about that?
Well, the best practices of identifying a potential suspect in a crime, Your Honor, are pretty clear, and what the best practice and what should have been done would have been a photo lineup of similarly some people that look somewhat similar to Mr. Cozy, and very critically and importantly, as research indicates, the confidential informant should have been told that the person may or may not be in the photo lineup, and so therefore you get an accurate, a more accurate depiction of just how well this person can truly identify the suspect.
So is it your argument that if you only have one photo, that is always a tainted identification?
It's certainly, I don't know that I would go so far as to say it's always a tainted identification, but it certainly would not be consistent with best practices and techniques that are based on recognized scientific literature at this point in time. Did you have a question?
That was my question. Does the Constitution require those best practices? Does the Constitution enshrine what the scientific literature has found? What is our standard?
Right, so the Constitution requires due process. And when you have identification procedures that provide an unreasonable opportunity for a wrongful conviction, I believe that would fall under the a very drastic due process concern, which has been recognized by this court and many, many, many others. The problem...
Counsel, at trial, did anyone else identify your client?
Yes, there was a woman who was the person who allegedly introduced G to the confidential informant, who did identify Mr. Cozy as the confidential... as the person who sold methamphetamine to Mr. Cozy.
What impact does that have on our case?
I think somewhat minimal. Notwithstanding, so I would agree that would be some evidence of Mr. Cozy's guilt. But the problem is, I believe, the primary evidence at trial of Mr. Cozy's guilt was the confidential informant's identification of him as the perpetrator of the crime. And when you have a confidential informant who has the sort of aura of being vouched for by law enforcement, that is a significant piece of evidence. This is the person who is actually there conducting the transaction with whoever.
How is law enforcement vouching for this witness?
Well, by saying, you know, this is a reliable confidential informant. This is someone I've used several times over. This person has provided accurate information in the past. They become sort of an arm or an agent of the law enforcement at that time.
your position is that taint is suggestive and it's tainted.
Absolutely.
But back to Justice Funk's question, can that nevertheless be overcome by an identification?
It can.
During the proceedings?
Yes. So in State versus Faust, 269-749, it's a 2005 case. This court laid out a list of five factors that the court should consider when it finds, like in this case, that the identification process was unduly suggestive, that an identification can nevertheless still be admissible. And those factors include the opportunity of the witness to view the alleged criminal at the time of the crime, the degree of attention that was paid by the witness, the accuracy of the prior description or lack thereof, the witness's level of certainty, and the time in between the identification and the confrontation or identification in court. And so here, I think the whole perspective needs to be...
Is that the analysis the trial judge followed?
It is. The judge did cite State versus Faust, although the judge, the trial court did not go through and indicate factor by factor how the evidence played in. It was sort of a more general conclusion. And what I want to stress is all of this, I think, should be viewed through the prism that this is a confidential informant who has made thousands of dollars over the course of hundreds of interactions.
Does that make the informant more reliable or less reliable?
Well, I think the fact that he's getting paid to do this and has received a substantial sum of money over the course of many years makes it less reliable, quite
were
frankly.
Were those facts pointed out to the jury during the trial?
Yes. But my position is that the identification should have not been allowed at all by virtue of the court granted motion to suppress. And there's a couple key factors I really think are important. One is, and that relates primarily to the accuracy of some of the surrounding facts. So for example, the confidential informant testified at the suppression hearing that he received the text message, "Is this the guy?" about 4 or 5 days after the methamphetamine transaction occurred. In reality, the transaction occurred on October, 17th, and that text message didn't come until November 9th, 23 days. So he was off by a lot in terms of the length of time it was in between when the transaction occurred and when he received the information. That's a significant detail that goes right to the heart of his ability to recall accurately what happened in that transaction. He also said he had conflicting testimony at the suppression hearing versus at trial about how long he spent in the vehicle prior to the sale, when they were planning it in the morning. He said at the suppression hearing that it was 15 minutes, and then at trial he said it was 4 or 5.
How does the fact that someone else identified Mr. Cozy at trial factor into the Faust analysis?
I don't think it factors into the Faust analysis.
You can't consider that someone else, doesn't that say something about how reliable the CI's identification was if it's corroborated by someone else?
For the purposes of trial, I would agree that that would be important, but
in this case, was it corroborated by more than one witness? Wasn't there another witness who recognized his voice on the recording of the controlled by?
There was.
So there are two independent corroboration?
That's evidence that I think the court should consider. But you know, the ability of someone who spent some time in a vehicle to accurately recall or identify voice, I think is of minimal importance in comparison to the testimony of the confidential informant. And, you know, the confidential informant had what I would just characterize as very, very significant errors. He also said that this person was bald, but then he was wearing a cap at the time of the transaction. And he said, I think he changed his testimony, he said, well, he took the cap off at some point in time, which he hadn't said before. And so there's just a lot of reason for skepticism that this confidential informant was accurate. There's also an indication that they tried to do a subsequent purchase. They called the same number that G had, and a woman picked up and said that this person, G, had been arrested. There's no evidence that Mr. Cozy had been arrested. So there's reason to be very skeptical of the identification of the confidential informant in which he identified Mr.
Cozy. What is this court standard of review?
So the standard of review is de novo. Obviously, factual conclusions or factual determinations that were made by the trial court are subject to clearly erroneous standard, but whether there was
a due process. What factual determinations did the court make that we have to give greater deference to?
Right. So I suppose that would be the reliability of the confidential informant. I would concede that the court should give significant deference to the trial court in that regard. But I think under either standard, there's enough reason for alarm about the accuracy of the confidential informant and subsequently whether Mr. Cozy was actually the person who committed this crime, that the matter should be reversed and remanded for a new trial in which that the identification of the confidential informant is not allowed. I see that I'm out of time. There's no other questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Duffy, good morning again.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Siobhan Duffy, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the appellee, the state of Nebraska. Appellant argues the district court erred in denying his motion to suppress the confidential informant's identification of appellant. The state believes the district court correctly overruled the motion, and we ask you to affirm the judgment of the district court. Appellant moved to suppress the confidential informant's identification of him as a seller of methamphetamine, claiming that the initial photo identification that occurred was unduly suggestive. After a hearing on the motion to suppress, the district court—
Do you agree that it was unduly suggestive?
Your Honor, the state doesn't necessarily agree with it. However, we recognize that the standard of review on appeal is that factual findings are reviewed for clear error. And some of the factual findings that the district court made led it to conclude that this identification was unduly suggestive. But because the second part of the analysis is whether the in-court identification is sufficiently reliable, the state believes that this case is more easily disposed of.
Is the unduly suggestive finding something we review as a matter of law or a matter of fact?
I suppose that whether the facts that would support it one way or another are reviewed for clear error, but the ultimate determination of whether it is unduly suggestive would be a matter of law, would be de novo, I believe. So this court—
So are you conceding that the law in this case is that this was unduly suggestive?
Your Honor, the state is not conceding that it is unduly suggestive. We just, in brief, chose not to challenge that portion of the district court's order because we feel that this case is disposed of more easily under whether the in-court identification was sufficiently reliable. Because
so is the message we give to law enforcement and so forth in Nebraska that if you have a one photo lineup and you ask the question, is this the person, that is per se unduly suggestive?
Your Honor, I don't think so, because I do think that it will really be very fact specific. For example, here, I think that the confidential informant at the suppression hearing did state that he recalled getting the photo and the message was, who is this, or do you know who this is? Not, but the officer did testify that he may have said, is this G? And the district court's factual finding was that the officer asked if this was G. But I think that even if he had asked if this was G, I don't think that it necessarily renders the initial identification unduly suggestive, because I do think that a court would look at the relationship to the parties, the prior history of the parties in working together, this confidential informant. So I don't think that it's necessarily per se always unduly suggestive. Again, in this case, the district court did find that it was, and the state did not challenge that in this appeal and just discussed the reliability of the in-court identification.
Well, Mr. Porter points to a lot of discrepancies. Could you address several of those?
Yes, Your Honor, there were some discrepancies, specifically in the amount of time that the confidential informant spent in the with the appellant during the transactions. But I think ultimately, and the thing with the hat, the parties had met in the morning and then arranged for a transaction to occur later in the afternoon, evening. I don't know that we have testimony about whether he was wearing a hat in the morning, and I think hats do very easily come off. So I don't think that
we
that.
We have testimony about whether or not he's bald.
The CI did say that he was a bald gentleman. I don't recall at trial if anyone specifically, when they were identifying the party at the table as the defendant, whether they noted that he was bald. I apologize, I don't recall from the record. But the CI did state that the man was bald. I think that even though there were some discrepancies with the amount of time that the parties spent together, I still think that ultimately it was several minutes in daylight, under circumstances where the confidential informant, having done work like this before, was aware that he needed to pay attention to the physical characteristics, and because he knew that he would later be called upon to identify this individual. I think sometimes, you know, if we had a situation where someone is randomly a victim of a crime, they may not be paying attention to what the party was wearing or what their hairstyle was. But in a situation like this, this confidential informant went into both situations knowing, I need to remember who this person is and what they look like.
That leaves us with an alert witness who at the suppression says 15 minutes, but at trial says 45.
Well, and I recognize, I don't really have a great explanation for that change in time. I don't know if maybe as time went on, the amount of time, moved. Obviously, he had a little issue with time. He thought that he received the text message 4 to 5 days later. It turned out it was, in fact, 2 to 3 weeks later. I think maybe more towards three, like 20 to 21. But I think that in...
So that's the 4 to 5 days, which is the 20-some days.
Correct. But ultimately, I don't think that that's a significant... yes, it's a discrepancy, but does that discrepancy really, is it really important in his identification? And I think what's important is that he, some of the factors that a court will look at when determining whether, if there was an unduly suggestive identification procedure, if it is still allowed, if an in-court identification will still be allowed. This court has stated that reliability is the linchpin in determining whether a subsequent identification would be allowed. And
how confident was the confidential informant in his identification? How did he articulate his level of confidence?
He was very confident. He was certain that the defendant was the individual who he met in the morning and who later sold him the methamphetamine. And the confidence of the level of certainty demonstrated is one of the factors that the United States Supreme Court, and which this court has adopted, is something that a court will look at, including the opportunity of the witness to view the criminal at the time of the crime, the witness's degree of attention, the accuracy of the prior description of the criminal, and the time between the crime and the confrontation.
Can the corroboration from other witnesses factor into the reliability analysis, or is that?
Your Honor, I don't know, and I can't recall from this court's prior case law if this court has ever stated that that is a factor to be considered.
Should we state it?
Well, I suppose if this court feels that that is something that lends credibility to an informant or a witness's identification.
Do you think it lends credibility?
I think certainly in this case it does. It does lend credibility. I mean, I think it supports the confidential informant's identification, his knowledge and his certainty. It certainly makes it more believable. We have the individual who was kind of the third party that sort of set
up. We have the United States Supreme Court saying essentially there are 4 or 5 factors. That isn't one of them.
No.
What should this court do with that information?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that in Mason v. Braithwaite, the 1977 case where the Supreme Court listed those factors, stated that they include these. So I don't think that it necessarily means that nothing else can be considered. And again, because reliability is the linchpin in determining whether that should be allowed, the identification should be allowed in, I think that having other witnesses state, yes, this is that person, does make it more reliable. I suppose in the context of a trial, it might depend on when the identification is made.
Were the witnesses saying, this is this person, or this is the person who engaged in the transaction?
Well, I suppose that's a good point, Your Honor. I believe that the third party that had introduced the confidential informant and the defendant, he was not there at the later drug sale transaction. So he was there during that initial meeting in the morning, and he testified, yes, this is the man, the defendant is the man that I introduced to the confidential informant. So, but the officer, the second officer who identified the appellant's voice as the voice that can be heard on the audio of the drug transaction would have been identifying appellant during the transaction, though I don't recall from the tape if it was, here's the money, here's the drugs, but it was.
Not necessarily a witness to the penultimate transaction.
Correct.
But witness to interaction with the defendant and the CI, perhaps.
Yes, so I suppose that of whether that can be considered in whether a later in-court identification is not so tainted by a prior unduly suggestive procedure would really be then very fact-specific based on the type of testimony or identifications from those other witnesses that could be included.
Are you arguing that the cumulative evidence rule or doctrine applies?
Well, I think my main point is that the in-court identification was properly allowed. Should this court disagree, I do think that it could then look and see there was a lot of other evidence at trial establishing appellant's guilt. So if this court were to determine there was error, I don't think that it is error that necessarily prejudiced appellant or warrants a reversal. And so
you would call that harmless error?
That's correct, Your Honor. We believe that if there was error, which again the state does not believe there was, if there was error, it would have been harmless. I see that I am out of time. Unless there are additional questions, we request you to affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? Thank you. That concludes our arguments this morning then. I want to thank all of the attorney participants and again thank everybody here at Scotts Bluff High School and everybody in Scotts Bluff and the whole panhandle for welcoming us to this part of the world and